Well, what was Ensign's excuse for not sounding the horn?
I cannot recall. I apologize for not being able to recall, but apparently there was enough extenuating circumstances in some way or other so that no punitive action was taken.
So it didn't put a dent in his career that
no,
much?
No, it didn't. I'm sure there was an investigation, a board of investigation was convened, but punitive action was taken, and it could, however, have largely been because of commencement of hostilities before they could finish up and come to.
Had more important
things to
worry
about.
This was
just a few days before Pearl Harbor, and with the whole fleet sunk out there in Pearl Harbor, they had
some poor ensign.
Yeah, they had more to do than worry about some poor ensign and the skipper of the ship. And had there been complete peacetime situation, I'm sure that probably there would have been some punitive action taken, without a doubt, because in those days, you were held strictly accountable. And as far as I know, then, with the coming of the 7th of December, a few days later, no punitive action was ever taken in the case at all. And everybody went on to promotion. As I recall, we were able to continue our mission, and maybe the Sabine was. I don't know where she was going. She was coming out, supposedly had a load of oil, but maybe she was in ballast and going back to the States for another load. She might have been on her way to San Diego for a load of oil, for all I know, at the time. And however, this is the background then of why they immediately canceled the orders for the case to go into dry dock and put the Shaw in dry dock instead. Otherwise, had it not been for that collision, it would have been the case that would have been in dry dock that morning, and that would have been the famous ship and not the Shaw, and a number of other things wouldn't happen too. I wouldn't be married to my wife.
Would the Shaw have remained on patrol out there? Would the Shaw have been on patrol at the time on December the 7th?
I don't think so. I think we would only go out for a couple of days at a time. We would not have been out there.
Ships out there patrolling that morning?
Yes. Yes, they were.
They were not involved in the carnage.
That's right, they were not. And they were more or less ships that were permanently out there for that purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would go in and replenish it. They were a permanent part of the
patrol.
They may have called it the inshore patrol, yeah. I guess offshore patrol really does extend out to maybe 50, 60 miles, and anything up to 10 or 20 miles is called inshore patrol. So I think we were on an inshore patrol that morning. Or that evening when we were out there. The orders were given then for the case to not go into the dry dock and for the Shaw to go instead. And the Shaw would get her buckle plates replaced, as well as all the new heavier plating in accordance with the ship alt, they call them, or ship alteration approved. So that is the reason why the Shaw was in that dry dock that Sunday morning and not the case, the division flagship. I believe that is pretty much background on that. And I would say, too, that we did have condition watches being so-called dawn condition watches being set in the ships out there during the fall of 41. I did want to mention that. This was by order of the commander-in-chief out there, and every morning before half hour before dawn, we'd have to have a man at least one anti-aircraft gun and a direct gun director manned. And then I don't think for a dusk. no dusk condition watches, because the flying boats had been way out 400 or 500 miles all during the daylight hours and come back in for the night, and they figured that nothing could come in at night, but they did have dawn condition watches. And so I believe that's the preparation up until that time. And could I inject before I start on the attack itself, if we do here, just one little thing that a bit of almost inconsequential history. When did I ever hear my first singing commercial on the radio? It was in the fall of, in the summer of 41. Mind you now, of course, back then on radios, they didn't have singing commercials. They had commercials on, but nobody thought up to put a little song on. And it was in connection with Dentine chewing gum. And Dentine chewing gum was advertised with a singing commercial come on over the radio station in Honolulu. And I'd never heard them before in my life. Well, that's the inconsequential, but I'll put it down. I have just a few notes here, which on the attack of the Pearl Harbor attack here, which I have made up about 21 years ago. And I happened to be rummaging through my desk just about 2 weeks ago, and I came across these. And so these notes were made up 20 years after the event, and are better than maybe in my memory 41 years after the event. But I made this up because they asked me to speak to the Rotary Club here, not when I shortly came, and I just found that I'd written these down, and I might just run through briefly the attack. And if there's any time you think we should cut off, why, just let me know.
I'm going to need to cut off in probably about another 15 minutes.
All right.
Considering
the
time.
Sure, that's right. All right. Well, it won't take, I don't want to put a lot of padding or clutter in anyway, so I think that I can get through here within that time. I've mentioned here, in just what I've already said, that there was some feeling of apprehension, but war didn't really seem close to us. I was not privy to higher intelligence, but I knew we were standing dawn condition watches, that there were anti-submarine warfare patrols by the inshore patrol off of Pearl Harbor, and knew that the big flying boats were going out for reconnaissance every morning. They'd be taken off about dawn to fly out several hundred miles off of Pearl Harbor and come back. I mentioned that the excavations for oil tanks going on over at Red Hill, just above Makalapa, and the warning message of November 28th concerning the hostile action to be taken against certain unidentified ASW contacts. And on the morning of the 7th of December, where the Shaw was in the floating dry dock, high out of the water, and we'd been doing, gotten started on some maintenance, and they'd already cut away some of the old side plating that was to come off the ship and was to be replaced with heavier plating. It's a nice, sunny, ordinary morning. The captain, the executive officer, and the gunnery officer and communications officer were all with their families at home in Honolulu. And I happened to be the senior officer on board. Now, we did have five or six officers on board, mostly ensigns. I was then a lieutenant junior grade and was the engineer officer. But we had a few others of varying degrees of experience, and really a fine group of men. But the normal liberty had been granted, and so we had up to one half of the, it was possible for up to half of the crew to be absent. I got up that morning and put my my bathrobe on, and I was in my pajamas, and
what no, time of morning is
about,
that?
About 7:15, I got up, and but I was on board. Remember, I was entitled to shore leave that weekend. I was not married, I had no home, and so I was not involved in standing any watches. I don't remember which officer did have the duty, but I was just there because that was just my home, that was my place to live. And there was no one in the wardroom. Of course, it's more informal in a destroyer than in a cruiser or a battleship, and so I did not get dressed, and I took the Sunday morning paper and was proceeding to read that over a cup of coffee. And I'd been doing this for perhaps, say, about a half hour, and was just on the verge of thinking I would go to back to my stateroom nearby and get dressed. As I was about to do that, I heard a couple or three big severe detonations, like bombs going off, and I said, my gosh, they aren't working over at Red Hill on Sundays, excavating over there. This sounds like something else. And then I heard a couple more big thuds. And I remember I jumped up from the transom that I was sitting on, the davenport, you know, all along the side of the ship. I jumped up there and on the starboard side of the wardroom and stuck my head out the porthole. And just as I did that, stuck my head out the porthole and looked. Here a plane went parallel to the dry dock and parallel to the ship from bow to stern, about 100 yards away, with a great big red sun painted on its side. And that's when I knew the day had arrived. A great big red sun on that.
What was your thought?
Oh, my God. It's hard to say. I tell you, I knew that the war had begun. The war had begun, and then about that time, I heard the machine gun going off on the stern of the Shaw. See, we had the morning watch, and maybe hadn't gone off, or probably had been secured.
Did they keep the machine guns loaded?
Well, they had it right handy, yes. They had ammunition right handy. There was just a single machine gun back there on the stern, and I heard that thing rattling off. Well, I ran to my room, which was adjacent to the wardroom, got dressed as fast as I could, and got into my khaki uniform, and I went roaring up to the bridge as fast as I could go, and I never went back to my stateroom. Never went back in there again. And just too busy, too many things going on. And I looked over there, and the attack had begun about 7:55. My first knowledge was this Japanese plane, which I said flew parallel to the starboard side of the ship in the dry dock, and then, of course, shortly after that, the general alarm sounded. The watch out on the deck had pushed the lever for the alarm, sounded the general alarm, passed the word to man battle stations, and I got to the bridge as fast as I could. Well, I looked over there, and I had a bird's eye view, practically, a panoramic view of the all the ships in the battle line, all the battleships moored two abreast, one to the to the pier or mooring piers, and then another one, battleship tied up immediately outboard of that. And there were about six or eight battleships all together right up and down that line, and cruisers moored elsewhere around the yard, and of course some way out in the bay with a number of destroyers. And I saw Japanese plane after plane come in there and fly. Get down close to the water, close enough maybe to get down 15, 20 feet above the water, probably it's higher than that, but it looked like low, probably it's 40 feet above, and drop their torpedoes in the water, and then short time thereafter why it would explode against the battleship. And when I got up there, why the battleships were already beginning to list heavily. They were already tipping over to port. They were all pointed toward me, facing the south. They always had them ready to go to sea, pointed outward. When they come in, they bring them in take the tugs and turn them around and then moor them so when it came time to go to sea, they were pointed fair for going out. And these battleships were pointed, to say, for going out, and therefore their port side was the exposed side. Planes, the battleships were pointed to the south, and the planes were coming in from the east at right angles, more or less, to the line, battle line, and dropping their torpedoes. And a lot of anti-aircraft fire going on. In the Shaw, being in the, on the keel blocks in the dry docks, of course, we couldn't fire 5-inch guns. All we could fire was machine guns. And I looked over to the, it was a well-coordinated attack. I looked over in the horizon to the westward, where Schofield Barracks are over there, the Army, all U.S. Army over there, and I saw smoke rising and coming up there, bombs dropped over there, I guess. I looked more or less to the east, and over to Hickam Field, where all the Army Air Force planes were, big Army B-17s and whatnot, and there's a lot of smoke and fire coming up from over there. And then it wasn't too long before I saw the Arizona, battleship Arizona, blow up. A magazine, whole magazine blow up, and I'll never forget that column of red flame, just a red flame, and seemed like it went about 100 or 150 feet in the air. That was ship's ammunition that was cooked off and blew up and just blew the whole bow off the Arizona, or most of it, I guess. And she sank promptly, went right down there. That tower of red flame at the time the magazine exploded made quite an impression on me. I have here Arizona blew up. And then the Oklahoma, which was ahead of the Arizona, or closer toward the Shaw, capsized. It just, it had been hit so many times by so many torpedoes, and they couldn't counter flood fast enough. Mm-hmm. So she just rolled over to port and was her belly up, was, with a lot of men still inside her. So she was, you could see all her, a lot of her bottom, particularly toward the port side of the ship. Of course, I wanted to get the dry dock flooded, and I had gone down early and seen an old-timer Mustang lieutenant, about old enough to be my father. It had been an old-timer, probably came in World War I, and he was a lieutenant, and he was the dry dock superintendent in charge of it, and he had gotten down there, and I said, let's get flooded as soon as we can. Set the ship down in the water. So if we get bombed, we'll have water around us anyway. Well, of course, he was handicapped by lack of personnel. This had come on so suddenly, and to get all the civilian personnel over there so that they could flood the dry dock was almost an insurmountable task, I guess. But he assured me he was working on it. I got a report from one of my officers, who apparently got it from the radio shack, he heard that the Japanese troops, amphibious troops, were landing over there on Barber's Point. I knew where Barber's Point was, to the west of us, in the same general direction as Schofield Barracks, but it's on the seashore down there. There's a lighthouse there. We go every time we navigate east and west. Out there, we're always taking bearings on Barber's Point. But he told me during the height of the commotion that it's been reported that Japanese troops are landing on Barber's Point. And then about that time, the battleship Nevada came floating down, helplessly, more or less, by the stern of our dry dock. There was the Nevada. She'd tried to get underway. They tried to, you know, to get there. They had steam up. They were, but in the course of trying to get out on greatly reduced power, I guess she grounded, went into the mud there, just off of the channel, more right close to the dry dock. So we had the a lot of smoke, black smoke coming up. Every now and then, I'd see some of the superstructure and upper works of the Nevada, and then the smoke would cover it up, and I wouldn't see the superstructure anymore. And then I guess a half hour had elapsed again since I last had walked down into the dry dock, gone over the side and gone down there. And so after another half hour, I went down again. This was perhaps about an hour after the attack had begun. Attack began at 7:55, and so this must have been about 9 o'clock. But I left the ship and went down into the dry dock and got a hold of the ship superintendent again, or the dry docking superintendent, I mean, and I said, when are we going to get flooded? This is urgent. They're apt to come after us any time now.
Here and they were still attacking.
Well, they were still attacking other, yeah.
More waves.
They were still coming in. More waves were coming in, yes. And they were still attacking. And we just got to pull the plugs on this dry dock and get it down so we can get the ship into the water. If we get hit, I'd rather have the ship in the water to put fires out. Well, he assured me that we're going to be, we'll soon be flooded. We got some people coming now and got machinery started up and air compressors and whatnot. And we'll get started and we'll have it flooded within a few minutes. That was the thrust of his statement. All right, so I got ready to go back up aboard ship then. And I was up near the stem of the ship in the dry dock and I looked up high and I saw, oh, 5 or 6, 7 thousand feet up there, with Japanese bombers in formation, high-level bombers on a steady course, and
so these were different from the Zeros coming.
Yes, sir. These are these were different from the Zeros and the torpedo bombers that were much smaller and coming in at high speed and dropping torpedoes. That's right. Well, these are great big heavy bombers way up there. Carrying a heavy bomb load, as I looked up there, they seemed like little specks up there. I saw them release bombs. I saw those silvery things get released and coming down. Well, I didn't know where they were aiming their bombs for in Pearl Harbor, but I had a good reason to believe that they could, well, we hadn't been touched yet. We'd been left alone, and they might be well coming down for the Shaw. And I watched a little more, and I could see they looked to me like they were coming closer and closer right to where we were. And so I, of course, couldn't, it was just, I had a few seconds left, just a mere few seconds. And I dashed over, and I got underneath the very stem of the ship and pressed myself against the foremost keel block. And those keel blocks were probably, up there were something like, I would say, 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet of solid wood. Heavy, you know, heavy like railroad ties, timbers all blocked together. And they were that way all along the keel. Every so many feet apart, you'd have a keel block. Mm-hmm. And the main weight of the ship would be taken on the keel blocks with some supporting blocks on the outside to keep it from tumbling over. Well, I got under the, I just ran, got under the forwardmost keel block and waited. I waited underneath there. And I could look out and see ahead, but I in the dry dock, but I couldn't see anything stirring. And I hadn't much more than gotten under there. And the bombs landed on the Shaw and in the dry dock. And they, it was just a perfect zero hit. Right exactly where they didn't aim for anywhere on the Shaw, they aimed for the bridge. Command center, you might say, you know, where the foremost is. Mm-hmm. And that's what they hit. Just about in the bridge area. And I just remember there was a colossal whoosh of flames. Flames shooting out, from at least from the bombs that landed in the dry dock. There might have been 5 or 6 bombs in that stick that it hit altogether, of which perhaps you might say 4 of them landed in the dry dock between the ship's side and the side of the dry dock, and maybe 2 of them went into the innards of the ship, went and exploded inside the the forward mess hall, dining hall, and places like that. So all I could see then, as soon as they landed and exploded, I immediately came out, and all I could see was a high wall of flame. And they may have been, magnesium bombs too. They may have had something in there that would really burn, because there wouldn't have been that enough material in the dry dock itself to support that kind of a fire. And so there was a tremendous wall of flame which persisted and just bathed the ship in flame. And it continued on and on. So I just calmly, I say calmly, I guess it was, I probably ran off the front end of the dry dock and over the brow, the little bridge, and on the dry land. Since it was a floating dry dock, it lifted the ship out of the water, and it was a floating dry dock, not a graving dock, not one that's dug into the ground. And I just ran off the dry dock over this large brow, and there I was on land. Jason, of course, now the place where the dry dock was raised and lowered had to be all dug out and excavated. You had to have a lot of water there to sink the dry dock and to raise it. And here we had the ship bathed in flames, on fire. Incidentally, that was right where the brow crossed from the top of the dry dock onto the ship, if you follow what I mean. See, when you to get aboard the ship from land in the first place, you would walk over the brow from the land onto the front of the dry dock, and then walk along the walk there. Then you'd climb the stairway, a rather high stairway, and get up onto the top of the wall of the dry dock, which was probably 10 feet wide on both sides, port and starboard. And then you'd walk along there and get on the brow from this top of the dry dock, and the brow would lead over to pretty close to the level of the deck of the Shaw. And this brow from the dry dock wall over to the deck of the ship was completely enveloped in flames, so that nobody could get aboard and nobody could get off the ship by means of the brow. So I went around, walked along the ground area there, back to the rear of the dry dock, and there I could see and assist in getting the men off the ship, and those that were on board the ship to get off went astern. They all went back and collected on the stern of the Shaw, and we had great big stages put back there. You might call them huge sawhorses, built like a sawhorse that a carpenter used, but they're 20 feet high to support stages and all in connection with welders, burning off the old side plate and putting new plate on the heavier plate on the ship. So fortunately, it was all rigged up back there for an emergency evacuation. Otherwise, the men would have had to put ropes over and slide down 20 feet down the ropes, or of course, if the fire was burning them, they'd have to jump and injure themselves seriously. But the men were climbing like monkeys or bees or whatever, coming down all this staging and getting down onto abandoning the Shaw over the stern and getting down onto the floor of the dry dock. And then from there, they jumped into the water and swam about, just 20 or 30 feet. Wasn't very far, just swam a short distance and came out all wet, but onto the land and safe. There was no brow back at the stern to get onto the land. They had to swim over. So I remember I sort of got in the edge of the water and pulled a lot of them out and helped getting them out onto the land. And then The fire kept burning, and flames were roaring there for about 30 minutes. I should say that that time of that, the bombs landed in the dry dock, which I have just described, was about 9:10. 10 minutes past 9, or about 1 hour and 15 minutes after the attack began. And at approximately 9:40, or 30 minutes after the bombs had hit the Shaw, the magazine in the Shaw cooked off, exploded, and that is where, that is the scene which the photographer from Ford Island took the famous pictures, the most spectacular picture of all of Pearl Harbor. The only one that would have surpassed it would have been if he'd gotten one of the Arizona magazine blowing up, but nobody ever got a picture of that. However, this fella, and whose name we have, he lives in Kansas City today, but I think as a photographer, but he was the one who took that picture with his camera at 9:40. And I remember when I was still around there, as a lot of us were, that when that thing cooked off, I was maybe about 100 feet from the dock. And I think probably the walls, the vertical walls of the dry dock, helped to divert most of the explosion mm-hmm. force upward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't come horizontal and hurt us on the land there. But I mean, when that thing cooked off, I was about 100 feet from the dock, that I ran and dived underneath a building, a shed, or a small warehouse, which was supported up on blocks so you could dive underneath it. And I dive underneath that, and I remember seeing out on the land there great big chunks of the pieces of the ship landing out there, burning, flaming, the hatches and doors and watertight doors and jagged pieces of metal all landing all around out there. And I don't think anybody got hit, but I know one reason I didn't, because I ran fast and took cover before the stuff could land. If you want to, let's see.
It's 1:30 now.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. I could cut it there, and we could continue from there next time.
This is the end of interview number 3.